Last Friday, you may remember, NASA officials announced that the L-CROSS mission that crashed a piece of space junk into the moon, that famous story, had found significant amounts of water on the moon frozen at the bottom of a darkened crater. And that discovery has energized space scientists to think it's time to reconsider again, to reconsider our goals for living and working in space. Should we rethink about going back to the moon if there's water there? What about other places besides the moon, about space exploration, space travel? And one scientist who has been thinking these thoughts for a long time now is Dr. Mark Sykes. He's director of the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, Arizona. He welcomes he's welcome back to the program. Welcome, Dr. Sykes.
Hi, Ira. Good to be back.
What did you make of that the moon water story?
It was terrific. What a great find. Water had possible evidence for water had been was found on the moon about 10 years ago with the Lunar Prospector that found evidence of hydrogen at the poles, and so raised the question. And finally, we have definitive proof that not only is there water there, but it's not just little molecules sticking to dust grains, but chunks of ice under the surface.
Mm-hmm. Does it say to you that we could, in fact, colonize the moon? Is there enough water there if we go to the right spot and set up something?
Well, we don't really know that yet because, this is one point, and whether there's a lot of water around it or whether it hit the rich spot right there is hard to say. But there's also some serious problems in trying to excavate, to build the infrastructure that would require to bring that stuff out of the very cold temperatures in which it's sitting and then make use of it.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you want to talk about space and space exploration. Are you then in favor of waiting to see if it's practical to go back to the moon? I know, the President Bush got the ball rolling again, but there's not enough money invested. We had that commission report that said, if you really want to go back, you're going to have to spend some serious cash on this.
Yeah, well, the Augustine panel, which was this presidential commission that was set up by President Obama, just released its report, and they had some very interesting things to say. First of all, that under the current budget profile for NASA, that we're not going to be doing anything beyond low Earth orbit. So forget about going back to the moon or any place else for that matter. So there's a decision that has to be made there. But also there's the question about what are our goals? And they made a very important statement in their report where they said that the committee concludes that the ultimate goal of human exploration is to chart a path for human expansion into the solar system. Mm-hmm. Now, that's something on its face which would sound like something beyond just going there, planting a flag, and coming back. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it raises the question of if you're serious about realizing that kind of a goal, what are the steps you have to take in order to get there?
Mm-hmm. And you think we should be thinking about that?
Absolutely. I have to say that I was inspired in that direction back in my youth in the 60s when we were working to go to the moon. And the public, whereas the budget was sold on the basis of we got to beat the Russians to the moon, send a man to the moon and then return safely, the public was really sold on the idea that this was the beginning of the space age, that in engaging in this activity, that we were opening up the solar system to future people living there and working there in the future. Now, that goal was never realized, and actually it was never really on the table because there's a lot of very serious questions that we have to ask, such as, is it possible for people to live and work out in space? I mean, we might be restricted by things like biology. It could be that the Earth is the only place that we could actually live. There are some experiments that suggest that at less than one gravity, one Earth gravity, that we don't develop right. And so that's, mm-hmm. those are some very important issues that could be addressed at locations like our space station.
Mm-hmm. And who would be thinking about these things? I mean, where is the right place to have these discussions begin or continue?
Well, ultimately, it's a decision that's going to have to be made by the president, mm-hmm. as to what direction he's going to set for our future, much like Kennedy. I think that we have gotten beyond the point where we can really afford to just have space spectaculars, go one place, come back, go another place, come back, just so that you have these press releases and pictures in a history book, but rather we should be doing activities and steps that promote the possibility of actually living and working in space, like we see in our movies and everything else. You know, this is something that I think the public embraces.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, talking with Mark Sykes, Director of Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, Arizona. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll come back and talk more with Mark and take more of your questions. So tweet us and get on the phones and phone in a question. Also, we have our folks going on there at Second Life, so find the Second Life folks and you can leave us a question from there, too. We'll be right back after this short break. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the future of space exploration with Mark Sykes, director of the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, Arizona. Mark, where do we decide the priorities with all the other things that are going on and that cost a lot of money now? How do we ask Americans to spend more money on going
into
space?
Americans are not spending very much money on NASA. It's about 0.5% of the federal budget. Mm-hmm. And back in the days of Apollo, it reached up to 10 times that fraction of the budget. And you can imagine having a NASA today with a budget of $160 billion. That would be interesting. Mm-hmm. But I think that the discovery of the water ice on the moon is important because it kind of highlights the importance of water itself. Water is probably the most valuable, for purposes of human exploration, it's the most valuable material that we can find out there because we can use it for fuel, we can use it for shielding against cosmic rays, and we can use it for supporting life. But the moon is not the only potential source of water near the Earth. We also are swimming in a sea of near-Earth asteroids. You know, if you wanted probably about a million objects that are greater than 50 meters in diameter, and half of those objects could be sources of water. And so by identifying those objects, going to them, scooping up material which would be frankly easier to get to than the surface of the moon, that might give us fuel that we could use to access the moon as well as do other near-Earth activities and go on to Mars and other locations.
So you're thinking of building a series of outposts on these asteroids or whatever we might call them?
Well, I think that if the resources are there, and again, this is part of the homework that needs to be done, that we'd want to see if we could set up robotic resource recovery stations to, you know, dig up material,
right,
heat it up, get the water out, and deploy a solar sail or something to bring it back to Earth orbit.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Elvin in Oakland. Hi, Elvin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Two questions. One is, wouldn't discovery of water on the moon, however little there is, wouldn't that indicate that if water's in as desolate a place as the moon, that you would think that it would increase the chances of life being other places that seem to be desolate? And since life depends upon, as we know, it depends upon water. And second, I know that people who spend just even a short time in the space station lose a certain amount of bone mass because of living in a weightless environment. Mm-hmm. And other detrimental effects. And when they return to Earth, they don't even replace all the bone mass. Some of the bone mass remains gone. Now, I know it takes about a year to get to Mars, and we don't know what the effects, long-term effects of going to Mars are in a weightless environment, and we don't know whether any kind of exercise regimen would be able to compensate and reverse the detrimental bone loss and other effects. So there's a big question there as to the habitability. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of what we know now.
All right, Elvin, let me get an answer. Thanks for calling.
In terms of your last point, yes, bone loss, the biological effects of low gravity on people in space, that's an area of intense ongoing study by NASA, and they're exploring ways through exercise, through perhaps, you know, some medications that could mitigate things like the bone loss, and that's an absolutely essential problem that needs to be answered before we have people spending a year, a couple years in space, going to Mars, coming back, or other locations. With regards to potential life in arid places like the moon, the ice that we find on the moon is not from the moon itself, but rather we believe that it is from the impacts of things like comets, meteoroids that have ice in it on the surface, and that material, if it gets up into these shadowed areas near the poles, which are in the dark all the time, so it's well below freezing year round, that it gets trapped there and builds up over, you know, billions of years, and so that's where that water comes from. So it's not, and it's also not in a liquid form, and we associate at least what we know about life on Earth with liquid water. But there are places in the solar system where there is other places where there are liquid waters, such as the giant moons of Jupiter have oceans underneath their surface. And we now think that the largest asteroid in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, named Ceres, may have a subsurface ocean there. And if it's had a liquid water under its surface where it's warm enough to be liquid over the age of the solar system, it begs the question of whether life could have evolved in that kind of environment. So fascinating science questions for future exploration.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get another call in from Scott in Brookfield, Connecticut. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
My father was an engineer on the Apollo program and knew Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and those guys, and I've been a space fanatic since I was a young child, and seeing the moon landing. My question or comment is that due to the enormous cost involved with, you know, in any endeavor into space, there's been a lot of reluctance on the part of our species, really, to really take a step back and look at the big picture benefit. And I think that if what we need is a vision to drive our species over the next, let's say, 100 years, then if we had someone who would bring that kind of a vision, maybe we could have people sort of reevaluate our entire financial aspect of society, capitalism, socialism, whatever method that we happen to be working with, and try and figure out more of an end instead of a means. Like money, I'm sorry, let me digress for a second. Money has tended to be an end in itself of late. And what we're missing, I think, and what the emptiness we're feeling as a culture is that instead of having a grand end, such as colonizing the moon or going to Mars or going to Jupiter or whatever, that we just think in terms of our pocketbook. So in order for society to make that next leap, wouldn't you agree that we need to have some kind of fundamental sociological or philosophical or some large kind of consciousness shift, mm-hmm, where we can change our point of view about what's important? Is it our pocketbooks, or is it the continued survival of the race?
Thank you, Scott.
I'd like to listen on the phone if I could, because I don't have a radio.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I think that's a good question, and we are, I think we're in a transitional period of time where we have a choice. Are we going to continue to try to do short-term goals, one-off events, terminal destination activities, or are we going to think in the longer term? As the Augustine panel says, it talks about human expansion into the solar system, so that when you have a goal like that, then you assess your destinations and your activities, and you ask the question, is that promoting that goal? If you're just going someplace and coming back, is that really promoting the goal of human expansion, you know, which is related to the survival and all that? We are ultimately limited by our pocketbooks, you know, because we can only buy so much on credit, and then people come knocking on our door.
Well, there's a question coming in from Second Life, from archivist Llewellyn, who says, well, what about other countries trying to get to the moon, too. Why can't we get together with those people, and what does it mean for geopolitics?
Well, I think that that's one way that we are able to leverage more bang for the buck is to cooperate with, take the lead in cooperation with other nations to achieve common goals. I think that certainly expanding into the solar system in a meaningful way, working and living is such a goal. And together we could find out, first of all, if it's possible, because just because we want something doesn't mean that it will happen.
Right.
And then if it is possible, if we want to walk through that door. And the nice thing is that when you have a goal like go back to the moon by a certain date, so you have a destination and a time, then that is probably the most expensive thing you can do because you're driven by those two items. Rather than if the long-term goal is expansion, then there's a whole bunch of homework that you need to do, and you invest in answering the questions that you need to answer, developing the technologies and the capabilities, such as something as simple as being able to fuel your spacecraft in space, which was something that the Augustine panel recommended. So then it wouldn't matter where your fuel comes from, thus whether it comes launched up from Earth or you get it from an asteroid or from someplace else. You can make investments in those kinds of technologies where, yes, that advances the ball forward, and on a time scale where, it takes as long as it takes with whatever the resources that you have, but you know the direction that you're going. So I think we need to move away from targets and dates, which are kind of event spectacular driven, and have that long-term thing. And I think that people are open for that.
I hear you were talking about
in the 60s.
I hear you also implying that we have to think outside the box more than we used to, about different ways to bring in, instead of carrying all the fuel with us, we get it off of an asteroid or something.
Instead of
building one spaceship like to haul everything up, we've had different kinds of spaceships. Maybe we have other countries involved. Maybe we have private enterprise. We subcontract some of this stuff.
By focusing on that kind of a long-term goal, then it allows you to explore the different paths that you might take in order to achieve that goal. I mean, the one thing that I found a little unsettling in the Augustine report was it talked about doing things that would provide the public and other stakeholders with a series of interesting firsts to keep them engaged and supportive. This shouldn't be breads and circuses. This is about identifying and achieving long-term goals that people can embrace. Back in the 60s, when, say, in 1969, if somebody said, where do you think we'll be in 30 years, in the year 2000, everybody would have thought that we would be on Mars and beyond, living and working in space, because that was the vision that people had, and that people were very supportive of that when it became apparent that that wasn't going to happen, that really wasn't the direction or the effort that was being undertaken, then I think people lost interest.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mary Helen in Boston. Hi, Mary. Mary, are you there? Oh, no. She dropped out. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get here's a question from somebody on Second Life. Can we at least start by planting things up there, I guess, on the moon to help support the atmosphere and possibly food, fuel for future missions?
If we're going to live and work in space, one of the areas in which we need to invest some make some investments is something called closed ecology life support systems, which involve recycling, growing plants, trying to generate as much of the biomass that we need to live and survive up there, which is, again, it's work that's been done by different groups at small scales for many years, but has some potential of decreasing the cost or decreasing the amount of material that we have to lift up from the surface of the Earth at $20,000 a pound to support people living and working in space.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Mark Sykes this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking about, are there any new, radically new technologies that we have to develop in order to carry any of this out, or is it basically tweaking stuff we already have?
Well, I think we shouldn't think that we're going to wake up one day and there's going to be warp drive. It'd be nice. I'd love it. That would be great. But there's a lot of technologies that we need to that we know about that we simply need to explore how to use them more, such as solar sails technology, electric propulsion systems. These are things that we're using in limited ways in some of our space missions, though actually support for solar sail research is now canceled. But there's
a private project though going on, right?
There's a private project. I think the Planetary Society was supporting that.
Yeah.
And after the missile went to the drink, I'm not sure what the status of that is now. But yeah, there's all kinds of new technologies, and that's something that the government it's a useful thing for the government to do is invest in these new things that may not be something that a company could expect to turn a profit on, but could bring our understanding of how it works and how well it is in different situations, so that companies might say, "Oh, hey, we can use that."
Mm-hmm. So what would be your first step if you wanted to get this ball rolling? How would you get the attention for to this idea, and what would you take as a first step?
Well, the first step would be for the president to articulate a long-term goal. To say that to embrace the ultimate goal articulated by the Augustine panel, that human expansion into the solar system is what we want to achieve, and that we're going to evaluate the destinations that we go to and the architecture of the plans that we do in that context. To what extent does it advance that ball? One of the first things is to identify where are the resources. You know, mm-hmm. Is there water up there? You know, where is it on the moon? Where is it in asteroids? Is it economically recoverable? The other, probably the most important biological question to ask is, you know, if the idea is to have people live for multiple generations beyond the Earth, is that even possible? Because if it's not, and frankly, experiments right now suggest that it may not be, then the fantasies of colonizing the moon, colonizing the Mars, are just that, fantasies that'll never happen. So that's a very important question to ask, and if we could put that centrifuge that was canceled in 2006 onto the space station where it was supposed to go, we could run the experiments to determine whether or not we are going to be limited by our own biology to living and working on the Earth.
Do you think the space station was a dead end?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Unfortunately, they don't really, the powers that be have not... right now the plan for the space station is to be deorbited and burn up in the atmosphere in the first quarter of 2015, mm-hmm. 5 years after it's completed. It's because they don't have any long-term plan for this facility, and they haven't put any budget for it. If the goal is to expand humans living and working in space, there's a lot of work for a space station to do. There's the biological experiments, which have to be done on the space station, on that centrifuge that I was talking about. If we're going to do resource recovery from asteroids, then we're going to have to test the processes that would be used in a zero environment, which would be provided by the space station. So if we have long-term goals of extending ourselves into the solar system, we need a space station. And so it would be a facility that we wouldn't really want to burn up in 5 years.
Amazing. All right. We've run out of time, Mark. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Ira. A real pleasure.
Interesting stuff to think about. Mark Sykes is director of the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, Arizona. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about solar power, how you can possibly build your own solar power plant right on your roof there, so to speak. It's personal solar power. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.